This is the current federal tax developments for the week of April the 20th, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, broadcasting this week again from Phoenix, here under our continued shelter-in-place rules. And we'll be talking this week about some of the various developments we've had during the week. We have at least one that's not really related to the whole COVID-19 situation. So at least we have something to talk about that's a little bit off topic. But we have a whole bunch of things related to the CARES Act and other items that are related to the current situation. So yeah, we're still going to have a whole lot coming on that. So let's start out and let's talk about first what's one of the key things you've been hearing about here at the end of the week. Basically, both the PPP loan program and the EIDL grant/loan program have run out of money. They are fully committed, shall we say, the funds are. So right now what's happened is that if you didn't get your loan in and your loan application has not been approved, basically you're stuck right now. We're not going anywhere for the moment. So it's both of the programs that had it. Now Congress, as I record this, I'm recording it at about 1:30 p.m. on Saturday, and this is here in Phoenix, Mountain Standard Time. So at the time I'm recording this, we have no word of any deal having been worked out. That might change by the time you listen to this. I mentioned online this week that it was an old line I heard in a podcast, I think about a year ago, that talked about Congress having two speeds, glacial and essentially light speed. And they moved from glacial to light speed with no warning. They normally run in glacial mode, but sometimes they just, once a deal's done, everything just happens so quickly you can't, nobody can even get a look at what the deal is because it's been done. So if we get a deal, it may happen very, very quickly. Conceivably, it could be done while I'm recording this. Probably not, but then you never know. So we'll have to keep our eyes on any deal. Now, you know, the problem is going to be that any such agreement right now, because they are not in D.C., they have no plans to return to D.C. It is either the Senate nor the House does until May 4th. So that's going to take out the coming week right in time and take out the week after that. So May the 4th, Star Wars Day, would be the first day they might come back to town. And I'm committed to that. So right now, in order to do anything, they would have to have unanimous consent. That means one party objects, and theoretically, they've got to haul themselves back to D.C., which they still don't want to do. They're going to stay away until May 4th, is their theory. So they don't want to come back to D.C. and do something. It's not clear right now. With unanimous consent, the problem is just one member in either party, in either chamber, could muck up the works. I have a bit of a concern that right now we are seeing each side propose something they know is a dead starter, not going anywhere with the other side, largely because they don't want votes, because if they had them, they're not sure they could control their members. That is a possibility that I hope is not the problem, because if it is, it would suggest we're going to have bigger issues trying to get anything done. But it could be an issue, so keep your eye. Now, events could force their hand, depending upon what happens. If the market reacts badly, if we see other things going on, there may be a case where Congress just has to act and they figure out some way to quiet down those who are objecting, or those who are objecting decide the cost of objecting just became higher than the cost of letting it go. So we'll have to see what's up. Now, people ask, well, what do we do now? I mean, there's no loan program. Do we just, you know, stop, ignore it, don't pay any attention? My take is, if your client is one who wants to get on the loans, they've now sat around, you know, they took a look at this, they either didn't get their application in early, or they were trying to go with a bank that didn't process it, or who knows why, but they don't have an approval at this point in time, but they do want to be part of the program. I suggest they keep getting information together to be ready to submit if and when the program reopens. I have been told by a couple of locations, at least a couple of emails have suggested that at least some institutions are still accepting information right now so that they'll be ready to go if the program goes live again. So I'd start pretending it'll be there, because if it comes back, again, they're talking about bringing it back with $250 billion worth of funding. And you might think, well, it took $350, it took a while to use that up. And, you know, we should be, you know, we got all those people covered, so $250 should last for a while. I'm not so sure. I think a lot of the reason why it took the $350 as long as it did to go away was because of the real problems of getting the program ramped up. So I'm not going to bet the $250 is going to last a real long time. You know, Congress may approve that, and by the end of the week they approve it, they may be out of money again. That's not totally out of the realm of possibilities. So I would suggest your client needs to be ready as soon as they will accept the information they need to be there. And if their lender's taking information now, you want to get in the line in a position where hopefully you'll be sent through before the $250 would go away. So that would be key. But we have to realize nothing has been extended yet. And if, you know, if they can't come to an agreement, nothing will be. So you probably also want to start working out with clients what happens if it doesn't come back. How does the employee retention credit work? What are the issues? You know, in fact, is the best course maybe to lay off the employees, let them file for unemployment at the higher rates that we're allowed to get these days, and will that work? Of course, the problem is in a lot of states, the unemployment system now is so overburdened, just trying to get in and apply may be a problem. So, you know, there are pros and cons both ways on that. And as I always point out to people, under the Payroll Protection Program, if you use that, you can use that to pay for the health care costs the employer was paying for. And if the employee was paying for others, then they kind of get those covered too, because it comes out of the employee's paycheck. So bottom line is, we may be ahead, you know, there may be a reason why that would be preferable in certain situations. We'll just have to see. But, you know, keep your eyes open for the program, because again, it probably will be back. Now, one thing that was kind of amusing, because this did not happen until the 14th, and funds ran out on the 16th. So there was a very narrow window during which we had actual guidance from the Small Business Administration on how self-employed were supposed to handle the loan application process. Self-employed and partners. This actually covered self-employed, partners, and it also covered a little bit on the forgiveness rules. And I say a little bit on those because there are huge questions that haven't been answered yet. If you've not seen Tony Nitti's article on Forbes, where he outlines the 10 things we need to know about the forgiveness calculation, like yesterday, you probably want to go check. You can just Google Tony Nitti Forbes. You should find that. Yes, if you thought the whole issue of figuring out how to fund the loans was a difficult run, knowing what counted and what didn't count, you've not seen anything yet. You know, this is going to make that first application process and what was in the max loan computation look simple. There are huge questions left to be decided about the forgiveness computation. It's not a no-brainer. This will be easy. We know exactly what we have to spend in 8 weeks. You know, we know exactly, you know, what'll count. We know exactly what won't. Reality is, we don't know a whole lot of those things. We don't know how the employee numbers, the full-time equivalent numbers, really work. We don't know how that 75% of the prior quarter's salary works. We got lots of issues, so just be aware of that. But here's what we know for self-employed, or at least what we knew for about 48 hours or less before the program shut down. For Schedule C, for sole proprietors, we were made very clear that for the owner, we're going to take a look at their 2019 Schedule C. If the return is not done, that's fine, but you still got to prepare a Schedule C. So Schedule C has to be prepared. We go down to the bottom line, the net income on a tax basis, bottom line for Schedule C. This is not net earnings from self-employment, because that would conclude adjustments for things like, you know, the payment of or one half of the self-employment tax to be removed. And that's not part of this. So it is not Schedule SE. It is Schedule C. It is that bottom line on Schedule C that you pick up as the earnings. Now, that's considered the salary, quote unquote, for the owner. If that is more than 100,000, you'll just treat that as 100,000. If it is less than 100,000, then you'll treat that as your earnings. Now, you will be able to borrow 2.5 months worth of the average monthly amount there. So divide by 12, multiply by 2.5. Note, you cannot add back any benefits for the owner. So you don't add back the health insurance costs. You don't add back the contributions to, let's say, a KEO or a SEP. You don't add that into payroll costs. You might say, well, wait. You know, if this was an S-Corp, we could have $100,000 of salary to the owner, and we'd add those. Well, I think the problem is, and why they went this way, but unfortunately it is unfair, the $100,000 limit, is because, let's say, if you had Schedule C income of $70,000 and you made a SEP contribution, well, you know, on the S corporation, what would really happen is you take a salary of less than 70, right? And so the SEP contribution would kind of already be in there reducing your salary. Because in this case, it's not already in there reducing the salary indirectly. We're not allowed to add it back in. We just treat that, and theoretically, you know, the SEP contribution, everything else is paid out of that. So they're saying, well, that covers all that. But as I noted, it is a bit unfair at $100,000 because, again, the S-Corp owner that gets $100,000 salary is still allowed to add in those other items. You're not here. So, yeah, that's a problem. Now, you know, here's the catch, though. When we then go to pay back the loan, now, this was a problem we thought all along. Okay, great. Maybe I can figure out how to fund it based on last year's Schedule C. But how exactly do we spend the money, right? You know, we're supposed to pay something during the 8 weeks. And what's going to happen here is you're not really going to pay, or maybe you are. It just depends on how you look at this. But you're not going to make any specific check disbursement to the owner that's going to qualify as paying their salaries. Rather, you will just be immediately deemed to have paid the owner, right? So salary cost for the owner will be 8/52nds of last year's, you know, Schedule C. So what? We're going to take the weekly amount and then, you know, take it times 8. So 8/52nds. Now, there's a problem with this calculation. Why? Let's say this is a sole proprietor. Let's take an Uber driver. So this is an Uber driver. They've got a Schedule C. They are the only person working in this Uber driving operation. They drive their car. Well, they're net. So they show net income, right? So they could borrow 2.5 months of average. So that's fine. But here's the catch. When you compute that number and then go back and compute this 8/52nds number, 8/52nds will not be 75% of the 2.5 months. It'll be slightly less than that. Now, why is that important? Because the SBA has been suggesting, at least Tony Nitti reported, some banks have told him that the SBA has been implying that the way you should read the interim final rule, and there's like three references in the interim final rule. One of them suggests this result, the other two don't. Well, they're saying, well, the one that suggests this result's correct, you should do it this way. Banks, certain banks have been telling their customers that if you got $100,000 from the bank under this program, you absolutely have to spend 75% of the loan. Over 75% of the loan has to be spent on salaries or nothing can be forgiven. Now let's go back to our single Schedule C owner. They get 2.5 months of their average earnings, right? And then they get 8/52nds of that as paid. They're going to end up a couple of $100 normally at the max, like I think it's around $200 or $300. They're going to end up that much short of 75%. And there's no other place to make a payment. Remember, the owner gets 8/52nds. We don't care what we pay them. We can't pay any other expenses, right? Payroll expenses for the owner, and that's the only person we've got. So bottom line, we couldn't get to 75%. And if you follow that theory, the 75% loan has to be used for payroll expenses. If the owner just borrowed the max or the bank just computed the max and gave that as a loan, and you have to get 75% as payroll costs, there would be no way to make that work. Now, I suspect at some point the SBA will figure that one out, and we'll see what they do about the 75% calculation, whether they do it that way or they come back and say what a lot of us think you should be saying, the way to read that is. Because remember, the 25%, the 75-25 rule was imposed by the SBA. It's not in the law. The SBA just determined that would be the rule. I suspect they'll need to relax that at least some and say as long as a certain percentage or whatever, or at least, you know, whatever your payroll costs are, You can only have forgiven one-third more than that, because that would be get you to 25% of the forgiveness came from the other expenses if you paid the other expenses. Now, yes, it does appear you can pay the other expenses. The Schedule C owner won't have a problem with that. Now, the other thing in this frequently asked questions that came out on the 14th, and the title is Business Loan Program Temporary Changes, Paycheck Protection Program, Additional Eligibility Criteria and Requirements for Certain Pledges of Loans. You want to type that into Google, you can find it. Better thing to do is download from CurrentFederalTaxDevelopments.com the weekly audio and video updates, download our PDF, and you'll find the link there to it, or just on the Current Federal Tax Developments website, we have a story on it. So you can just find the link there and get this document. We are told there that with partners, because there's this question, you know, did partners all have to go out and get their own loans as self-employed? And so did they all have to apply with the bank? Or was there some other way we did this? Because the SBA has totally avoided talking about partners. The law never mentioned partners. The SBA had never mentioned partners until the 14th. On the 14th, they finally mentioned partners. And they tell us that partners, you should take their self-employment income for those partners who are active in the business. Their self-employment income will be deemed to be their salary. Now, we don't know if there's an 852nds rule here or not. I mean, we don't really know on partners how we pay them, because there's just a very, very brief discussion of partners. However, what we do know is that we were supposed to add that to our max loan, and somehow paying the partners, however we pay the partners in this theory, which could just be that 852nds calculation, that has to take place. And now we're told, oh, that's inside the partnership. So the partnership is an entity applies for the loan. And in addition to the partnership's employees, the regular 941 employees, you add the partners to that list. Well, great. We know that. Isn't that wonderful? Except here's the problem. Many, many banks were rejecting any position like that. And certain nobody had any direct authority that said SE income for the partners counted and they were employees. So many banks only accepted the 941 W-2 numbers, believing that the partners would apply on their own. Now, SBA tells us, no, don't do that, because that'll just clog up the system with too many partners in there, and there could be double counting and, you know, all these issues. So now the problem is there is no mechanism in here. Remember, we're told we can only get one of these loans. And there's no mechanism, if you had been approved and the funds dispersed, to go back and change the loan request and increase it for extra. And again, and now we're out of money anyway, so, you know, even if they decide you could, remember, there's no funding left to do it, at least currently. Maybe there will be by the time you listen to this. So the problem is there's a lot of partnerships where either they just didn't apply at all because they were waiting on this and they got in very late and couldn't get in, or they got a loan that covered their employees, but the partners are out in the cold because the partners, it turned out, can't apply on their own. Now, the other catch is, like I said, when we get back to forgiveness, benefits paid in the Schedule C are not going to count in your forgiveness calculation. You know, they'll count when you pay them for the employees, but for the owner, they don't count. For partners, we just really still don't know what could count for forgiveness. Okay, we did find out one neat little thing, though. There have been a lot of questions. If you took a look at utilities in the interim final rules, one of the things they told you, utilities included transportation. Now, there was a lot of interest of what exactly is transportation utilities. And in the self-employed area, in this particular final interim final regulation that came out, the interim final rule that came out on the 14th, the second IFR, we are finally told, they in passing, they say, well, utilities include, you know, that this would be like fuel for vehicles will count as a repayment expense. So, you know, the fuel for the cars counts. Also, it did state right up front, which we pretty much knew, but at least they say it openly now. If, like, you had a car loan, interest on the car loan will count. Now, remember, principal does not count. The mortgages are only the interest. So principal does not count, but we do get the interest. So transportation says things like fuel for the car, you know, that counts as utility. We may decide that, and that would open up a question, with things like maintenance account, I think probably, but, you know, we just don't have that totally. And as I say, we got a whole huge bunch of questions about repayment that we just don't have any answers for. It's bad. Okay, next development we'll go on this. This one came out on Friday, on the 18th of April. Revenue Procedure 2020-25. And this revenue procedure talks to us about qualified improvement property, okay, QIP. And if you remember, as part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, Congress tried to simplify what was three categories of improvement property, move them into one, but still have them be 15-year property and qualify them for 100% bonus depreciation. Congress, unfortunately, forgot to actually write it that way in the law. And what they ended up passing made qualified improvement property 39-year property, not eligible for bonus, but that was eligible for 179, which is an odd combo. Okay, clearly that wasn't what was intended. The committee reports were very clear. It was supposed to be 15-year property. It was supposed to qualify for bonus. Well, that became what's known as the retail glitch. And we've been going back and forth about getting it fixed. Finally, as part of the CARES Act, it was agreed to fix it. But now we got a problem. We had to file our 2018 returns using 39-year lives for the property unless you took 179. And we were filing some 19 returns already. That probably used that as 39-year property because, remember, we knew that the attempt to fix this had failed as part of the year-end, act that was passed, including the Secure Act and other items. So now the problem is we have this new method. Retroactively, this property should have been 15-year property. So in Revenue Procedure 2025, the IRS gave us some options. Okay. You can either elect to amend the 2018 return to do a 15-year life, right, fully eligible for bonus. We can also make a late election to do or undo, our elections on choosing bonus or not. Or we can treat it as an accounting method change in 2019. Now, you may say, but wait, I've already filed 19. Well, here's how this is going to work. You have until October 15th of 2021, You have until October 15th to go ahead and file, right? To October 15th of 2021. Yeah, that is my date. Yeah, make sure that's right. So we have to October 15th of 2021 to do a late amendment or to do and do maybe a late accounting, late amendment change if we want to. So we have until that date to make up our mind. We could do an accounting method change, or we can just do from an impermissible to permissible, or we could go back to the prior year and amend the return, right? And we have until 2021 to make that decision about doing that. So that's nice. That's a nice choice. Now, here's a practical problem, though. The IRS is not accepting paper returns right now. If I want to amend 2018, that could very well create or increase a net operating loss. It's certainly going to generate, at a minimum, if it doesn't create an NOL, which would be eligible for a five-year carryback to 2013, it would certainly create a lower taxable income. That should, in theory, lead to a refund of taxes. But since they're not processing amended returns, because they're not processing paper, it may take us a long time to get that check. And we can't actually do the NOL carryback, even though we can fax that in. We'll discuss that here shortly. Even though we can fax in an NOL carryback, the problem is that you can't process the carryback till they process the amended return to put the NOL in the system. We're kind of stuck. We can't get the money. So some people may prefer to an accounting method change in 19, create the NOL in 19, right? Or create the reduction of tax in 19, because that 19 return can be electronically filed now instantly, and we can then do all of our stuff, do the carrybacks, fax it in, go ahead and reduce our tax for 19. We can get our money a lot faster, is what it would appear in many cases if we do the 2019 return. So we may want to do an accounting method change on the 19 return to modify this. So interesting change how it would go, right? And so we could amend through 10/15/21. If the return's not already filed, you'd select your options now. If you filed it and used 39 years, you'd go back and potentially change the return and fix it for whatever you want to do. They do have the automatic accounting method change procedures inside 2025. It also has a lot of options for some of the various 168 elections that you may now want to change because we've changed, what these things are going to do for the life. So certain elections may not make sense. And there's a whole slew of them we can make under 168 for purposes of the bonus depreciation rules generally. So we have those options for things for different types and all of that kind of stuff. We're going to open that up. So if you do have qualified improvement properties there, now, one other key warning, remember, we did open up the Bipartisan Budget Act partnerships. There is information there about integrating this with that. Generally, that option to go outside of the BBB audit rules is going to take precedent over this, and you're going to correct using that program instead of using this one. But it does explain how that could work. And if you don't use the BBB, how you could, then do an accounting method change. And they discuss all those options in here. So in any event, interesting thing. And if you got a client of qualified improvement property, that does tell you, this ruling does tell you how to fix it. So you want to be looking at the fix. Now, here's a big thing that came up. We got temporary procedures to fax certain forms 1139 and 1045 due to COVID-19. This was posted on the IRS website on the 13th. As I said, the IRS is no longer processing paper returns. But Congress put in these NOL rules, right? We now get to carry NOLs back 5 years. And Congress said you can use attentive refund rules that require the IRS to pay the refund quickly, 45 days, or, basically get nailed with big interest. So the idea was to get that money in taxpayers' hands quickly. Well, how are we going to do that? Because 1045s and 1139s had to be filed on paper. So how are we going to do that when the paper returns are just sitting in literally trailers at the service center? They're just piling up in trailers at the service center until the service centers reopen. So how are we going to do this? Well, the IRS created, they said, we're opening up two fax numbers, which opened up on Friday, right? They have a fax line for Form 1045 for individuals, and they have a separate fax line with a separate fax number for Form 1139 for corporations. Those numbers are contained in the FAQ. Again, download the PDF. We've got them in there so you can get your numbers, what you need to file. You'll be able to file those two things. Now, what you're going to do is fill out the paper 1139 or the paper 1045, and then you're just going to fax it in, right? They make it very clear this is a temporary solution. Due to the current situation, they do not plan to keep the fax option open forever. Now, note, this is our third fax option. Remember the Form 7200 came out? The only way to file 7200 is by fax? Well, these two now have a temporary option to file by fax, and every one of them has a different fax number. You cannot send other items to the fax number. Do not try to use this to send in a 2553. Don't use it to try to send in an 1120X. Don't use it to try to send in a response to IRS correspondence. It's not, none of those other things are going to be accepted on this. They said if you send something in, it doesn't work for this, it will just be held and, then they may process it just like the mail after everything comes back. So don't send other things to this line. It's not going to go. It's not going to get anywhere, they're telling us. It's just going to be stuck. They're not going to process that forward. Okay? The other catch is, we're going to do it started Friday, and you can only go 100 pages. And that's also a big thing to remember. We can only go 100 pages long on this. If you have more than 100 pages, what they tell you to do is, we will contact you if we need more than 100 pages. Now, on the 16th, they came back and they added some information to the fact that they posted initially earlier in the week. And these are all corporate-only items, which was interesting because many of them would also appear to have an impact on individuals. Whether that means that there will be a different answer for individuals, or whether it just means that the, you know, let's say the large business and industry group came in and said, well, you got to publish this right now and tell people not to do this or to do this this way. Not clear why it's only the 1139 and the corporate issues that are discussed, but it is. The new ones only discuss those. They said right up front, there is no fax system for 1120X. You cannot send in 1120X, you know, to the system. That's no good. And secondly, remember, the 1120X, also, if you have any 1120Xs you had mailed to them, you know, that are sitting in the trailers now, tough luck. We're not going to be processed. And if you have a carryback that impacts those, you're not going to be able to do anything with the carryback until the 1120X is processed. So it's going to really gum up the works. And remember, we may need to amend. If you want to go back and do the 2018 change for qualified improvement property, I need an amended return. And I need it processed. And then I could do my carryback from 18 to 13. So, yeah, we have kind of problems here. Also, if you want to do your carrybacks using the 1120X instead of using the 1139, because remember, using 1120X requires the IRS to do a more final determination than does the 1139. The 1139, the refund can be recovered essentially under the math error procedures. While for a 1040, well, if it's an 1120X and they make the refund, then they got to go through all the formal procedures to be able to come back for that money from you. So maybe you'd prefer to do the 1120X for whatever reason. Well, if you're going to do that, you're going to be waiting. Okay, that's why I said on the QIP, you might decide to make 19 your year of change. Not because it may be the best, but it may be the quickest way to get the money. And if your company just needs the money, right, your client needs the money, it may be better to go for quick right now than what's ultimately the largest, but we'll have to wait and see. We have no idea when they'll start processing. And let's please remember, processing 1120Xs has never been a super fast thing for the service. I can't imagine when they get back in and start trying to undo the trailers that it's going to go faster then. It's going to probably be, if nothing else, significantly slower, depending upon what types of things they have to do in terms of social distancing, when they reopen the center. You know, if you looked at what was discussed in the White House's outline of how we reopen, you're going to discover they're talking about things like social distancing as we open up a business. Well, what that means is, to be obvious, that's going to limit the number of people that could be processing things, because let's say, you know, you got this big area where you had all the people crowded together, you know, in their little cubicles, right, that are really tiny, and you've got them all in there together and there's not 6 feet between people. Well, you're probably going to have to spread things out. And spreading things out means we're not going to be able to put as many people in. Not as many people in means, not going to process as fast. So that could be a real problem, right? Now, they do tell you, the 1139, interesting enough, Congress told us, remember when they accelerated the minimum tax credit for corporation, they said we could do a tentative refund claim to get it. Well, the current form of 1139 has no way to do that directly. They tell you in this, on the website here, in the frequently asked questions, they tell you exactly how to fill in the 1139 and supporting forms to claim that accelerated minimum tax credit. They also tell you if you have both an NOL and the accelerated minimum tax credit payment, which you very likely will, because why do you need accelerated? Because you don't have much income, probably going to generate NOL. They tell you also how to do the dual on the same form to both get the refund of the minimum tax credit and to get your NOL carryback, the refund from that, on the same form. Those instructions for a corporation are there. Individual, remember, we don't have any special minimum tax refund rules, so this would not affect individuals, right? They also tell you the documents to attach to the form 1139 when faxing it in. So they tell you, remember, we only got 100 pages to work. So they're actually being very explicit. If you've done NOL carrybacks before, you know it, especially, it wasn't as bad recently, but for many years it's kind of been a game where the IRS seemed to try to figure out something they claimed you didn't tell them that they needed so they could kick it back and restart the 45 days. And it'd be this back and forth that often happened. So, you know, you kept sending stuff. Well, obviously, you know, they do not want a 600-page 1139 that's been filed so somebody can say, well, you can't claim I didn't send you something. It's there. So what they've said explicitly is what has to be attached now, very directly a checklist, and this is what we want. And if we need something more, we will just simply contact you, right? So we'll see how that works. But yeah, with the limitation on the fax size, I think seriously, yeah, they had to get better at that. Okay, that was their background. Now, P10 rules. Hey, first thing we got that's not really coronavirus related. This is good. We got proposed regulation 11117138-17. Proposed reg 300.12. It's on April the 15th they put this out. The IRS has announced that they are going to lower the government share of the P10 fee from $21 to $33. Now, caused a number of people to say, we didn't pay for P10s. What do you mean lower a fee? It was zero. How can you lower zero? Well, we'll get to that in a second, what it's there. We will still have the third-party fee, which is about $14. So you pay about $35 to get it renewed when you go. Probably most of you will go for renewals at the end of the year, so you pay at the end of this year. What you have to remember is, why weren't we paying for P10s recently? Well, there had been a U.S. District Court decision that had held in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, had held that the IRS was not allowed to charge a P10 fee. Now, this was a follow-up to the Loving decision, where, you know, that was when the IRS was going to set up this licensing system, and they were going to test people and require people to pass a test in order to be able to prepare tax returns. So you'd have a registered tax return preparer. You had to be that. If you weren't an EA, a CPA, or an attorney, you'd have to be a registered tax return preparer to do it. And in the Loving case, the District Court and the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia both said that's an overreach by the IRS. They have no authority to regulate that preparation, so they can't do that. They can't impose a regulatory licensing requirement. That goes beyond what the law authorizes. Now, what happened was, so some people said, well, if that's true, then why, you know, then they shouldn't be able to charge for P10s. Because part of the reason for charging for P10s had been because they were going to fund the program with the P10 fees. So they went to court. And the district court said, yeah, I like that. The problem was, and I looked at this when they actually released that case, was, wait, the district court, the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, in the Loving case, had very narrowly written their objection to be solely over that new licensing system. It never said a word about the IRS not being able to charge a fee to give you a P10. The district court said, well, they can't. They're not giving you anything. The Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia reversed and remanded the case. The Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, and this was in 2019, they said that, wait a minute. No, the government can charge a fee if they're giving something of value. And they said, look, this is allowing preparers not to be using their Social Security number. That is for identity theft, etc., a huge benefit. You remember the old days we had to give our socials, or we had to put our socials at least on the one going to the IRS, which the taxpayers signed so they could see our socials. We don't have to do that anymore. They're saying, well, that's a significant benefit. And the IRS has a right to charge a user fee to recover the cost of providing that program. And they do have a valid reason to have a P10 number on everybody in order to handle, you know, the various disciplinary actions that they are allowed to do under Circular 230. So the Court of Appeals said, District Court, you overstepped your bounds. They're okay with that. But they said, but the fee does have to be reasonable, so we're sending it back for a retrial on reasonableness. Now, the IRS now finally went and updated the regs to come up with a new fee, and they did drop it to $21. Theoretically, though, this case still sits in front of the court for remand on this. Some people have criticized coming out with this before the court decides, but my guess is the IRS is going to argue before the court that a $21 fee is reasonable and will ask for the right to go forward on this. So right now, just plan that at the end of this year, you will be paying. You won't just renew your P10 by going online and saying, yep, I'm still here. No, you will have to go online and actually also pay up. That will be part of this year's issue. Finally, back to COVID-19. We have a frequently asked question about a problem when we close the service center. It turns out, and this is frequently asked questions, the state tax form 706 deliveries returned due to COVID-19. It was the IRS web-based posted on the 13th. The IRS has now closed all their service centers, and that included the Kansas City service center that was receiving estate tax returns. Okay, so here's the problem. The private delivery services, this is where the problem came in. Some private delivery services, we don't know who, we don't know if it was all of them, we don't know if it was just one of them, but some people that use private delivery services had their packages arrive at Kansas City. The driver pulls up and gates are locked, place is closed. No place to go with the package. So the driver, like they would often do, say, well, it's closed, right? So they took the package and took it back, said they're closed indefinitely. And so the private delivery service then sent the package back to the sending party. Now, this is a problem because, of course, that was filing your 706 and you had a date it was filed by, right? You had got the documentation, you'd done everything. Now, suddenly, this package is sitting back on your desk. Well, this guide outlines how we're going to solve that problem. And it tells you about there are three basic ways to solve. There are three different solutions depending upon what exactly happened once it came, once it bounced. Now, when it bounced, you may very well have been notified that it was bouncing and they were planning to bring it back to you. The IRS said if you could contact the delivery service and ask them to attempt redelivery. The IRS apparently has set up some way that they can deliver the package to somebody sitting there ready to take them, right? So the 706 could be put in place. Okay, good. And if that happens, then your original mailing date is no problem. You're in good shape. But what if they won't do that or the package has already arrived on your desk? So I've got this package from the private delivery service. I sent it through them in a way that would prove filing, and now it's back on my desk saying, you know, with a note, hey, these guys were closed. Well, the IRS said, okay, don't open the package, okay, and just maintain, go on the website for the PDS, get the evidence of the attempted delivery and when you originally mailed it, keep that together, and eventually you're going to resubmit both to them so that they can process it, and you'll get the filing date as of the original date. Well, what happened is, look, they dropped this on my desk. They said, tough luck. What if, and you know, this might even happen in your office automatically, that somebody opens up the packages to figure out what's in there, right? And then send it back to the partner, whoever. So the package is now open. Okay, well, if the package is open, then they tell you to get some other information about how you attempted delivery and how you've mailed it and get all that stuff together. And then eventually you will send that level of information back to the IRS along with what was in the package. And they do ask you to preserve the envelope. Now, I don't know what happens if you threw away the envelope. My guess is that'll be more interesting and we'll see arguments over that. The good news is as long as you mailed it after April 1st and the due date was after April 1st, we should still be covered through mid-July. And hopefully we can actually get things delivered there by mid-July. But just in case we can't, and just in case you got this problem, this revenue procedure, or this basically, not even revenue procedure, I love how they do things in facts now. This fact will tell you how to handle it. Well, hey, CPA really is getting going. I have done a number of, for Idaho and Arizona, we've been doing some back and forth and some quickie one-hour sessions that we've done, free for those societies. I do them back and forth. So we got a couple of those we've done. And those have been really quick, and they've really been highly informal, kind of, well, here's what's happened, since last time we talked. And we're doing those. But now we're getting set up to actually do a regular old update course because we're actually getting what's usually regular CPE season. And I'm talking with a number of state societies about putting the courses together and getting them on the schedule here fairly soon. But I do have one already announced, so I'll mention it. The Idaho Society of CPAs is going to do a webcast. Now, Idaho asked me to do it this way because members had asked them to do it this way. We're going to do an 8-hour course, but it's going to be given in 2 4-hour segments on 2 consecutive days. So we're going to do it the morning of May 19th and the morning of May 20th, right? It'll start running. We should start running, if I remember my timing right, it will be at 8:30 a.m. Mountain Daylight Time. And we'll run, for these 4 hours, or basically 4 CPE hours. So that'll run till noon, Mountain Daylight Time. Have to watch, I'm in Phoenix, we're Mountain Standard Time. So we're always Mountain Standard Time. So like I said, when I was talking about doing the Idaho sessions, it's like two states on the same time zone, 1 hour off. So yeah, we're just a little different there. But we'll do that on those 2 days. Why we're doing that? Because the request was that given the way things work today, the members were concerned that if things are still as up in the air, that they really need to be able to get a hold of clients and have some time to talk to clients every day. And they didn't really take out the full 8 hour day. So we're doing 2 fours. Got a couple, none of them yet ready to announce that we're talking about to maybe do a couple of others for other state societies. So we're doing that. This will be basically COVID-19 tax law changes, the current federal tax developments. And what it's going to be is all that stuff since you took your tax update. And it does mean it will cover the 2 major and maybe 3 or 4 by the time we get there, pieces of legislation for COVID-19. We're also going to talk a bit about the Secure Act. Remember when the Secure Act seemed like a big thing? Well, as I want to remind people, that thing's still there. And if that was one of those things, they're going to take something about that, you know, when we got to CPE season, because I figured out immediately it had no direct effect on 2019 returns. So I'll just wait and take a look at the 2020 returns. You know, I knew about some of the extenders. I figured out which of those were important for 19. But otherwise, I'm just going to do the 20. I'm going to go ahead and take a course. Yeah, well, we still have that. So we will talk about at least some of the highlights there. But the vast majority of the course is going to be on the COVID-19, the payroll tax programs, the loans, where we're at with that. We're going to probably take a look at, you know, whatever we can figure out about the forgiveness calculation, because by the way, that'll be getting toward the end. That'll be now we're getting through the 8 week period, and it's like we got to start trying to figure out what the heck is a forgiveness calculation. And so we'll see what we know about that there. That, as I said, Idaho Society has that right now. If you're an Idaho Society member, you know, you can go ahead and log in, go ahead and sign up. It's a regular course, so you've got that. So the early sign up discounts are running right now. And as I said, we probably will have a couple of more to announce here shortly, but we'll wait and see when those are formalized. So far, they're not formalized. We're very close, but we just don't have anything formal. And so until the state societies formally announce, I will hold off on giving you any formal information there. So this has been the current federal tax developments for this week of April the 20th of 2020. Things actually slowed down the last part of the week. It was amazing. It was like having like a full day until we actually got the qualified improvement property guidance at the end of Friday. It would actually been very quiet the last half of the week. Comparatively, nothing happened. That was kind of big, but yeah, it came in late. You want to make sure, though, to check on the website for updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You also want to send any questions or comments. You can send them to me, Ed Zollers at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter, at Ed Zollers. Tax Twitter has been an amazing place to find out about things when they happen. That's where I found out about most everything that's happened on Tax Twitter. And then later, I get an update or a bulletin from somebody telling me about it. It may be an hour later or, you know, whatever. But we find out about things because somebody will notice it when the IRS posts something. And so that'll start the whole process going. So Tax Twitter has been really helpful there. I understand Twitter is a mess for everything else, which it is. It's a total mess. But it's very useful for getting on top of that as long as you follow the right people to get on that sort of thing. I also have been doing discussions. You'll see me a lot on the Connect groups for New Jersey and Arizona. I also monitor some of the Connect site for Minnesota. And I do take a look at California's Tax Talk. That one is open to any CPA across the country. You can go to the California Tax Talk site. I also take a little bit of look over on the subreddit /r/taxpros on Reddit. That's an actually relatively rational, good place to go. It's not the mess that is /r/taxes. /r/taxes, that's where the general public is, and all kinds of weird things go there. So yeah, you want to kind of stay out of there. But Tax Pros is a good place, and so we check things there as well. What's going to come up this week? We are going to hope for some guidance on forgiveness. That's really the big thing we need right now, and hopefully we'll get it. We also will take a look at if the IRS is going to give us any additional guidance on other items that are part of the CARES Act that, you know, need implementation at working. The QIP was the big thing we were waiting on. So we got the NOLs, we got the QIP, you know, so we got some of the big stuff is there. We may get some more clarifications on the payroll taxes and some other issues. So we'll keep our eyes there. But I think, you know, a lot of the really we need it right now stuff has gotten out from the IRS. Now, if we can just get out of the SBA, that's the one we need something from right now and the one we're having more trouble with. But we will take a look, let you know what comes up this week, see if anything else happens, see if we get new legislation, because remember, we're still trying to get that program funded again. And is there a chance that when they finally do a deal, they'll be, well, if they do a deal, kind of by definition, there'd be other things in there. So, and will some of those other things be taxed? Well, reasonable possibility of that. So we'll cover anything they do there. But otherwise, take care, stay safe, and we'll see you next week here on Current Federal Tax Developments.